Welcome to Energy Law Roundup, your comprehensive weekly briefing on legal news and developments in the energy industry from Texas and across the country, always in 30 minutes or less. And now, your host for Energy Law Roundup, business litigator and oil and gas trial lawyer, Tom Charlone.
It is the week of December 4th, 2017. Again, my name is Tom Charlone. I'm a partner in the Houston office of Kane Russell, Coleman & Logan, where I serve as the head of our firm's energy practice group. This week on the podcast, we're very excited to be unveiling a fantastic new six-part series. Recently, Kane Russell's energy practice group presented to the Association of Corporate Counsel right here in the great state of Texas. We called the program an Energy Law Mini Summit. And basically what we did was put together a half dozen presentations on a variety of key and emerging topics impacting the oil and gas business. The first installment in this series comes from Bruce Flowers, one of my partners based in our firm's Dallas office. Bruce is going to talk to us about pitfalls and best practices in purchase and sale agreements. Bruce has decades of experience with environmental issues and due diligence, including all types of soil and groundwater contamination and toxic torts. This includes extensive experience with the Clean Water Act, CERCLA, and the Texas Solid Waste Disposal Act. Bruce also has significant experience drafting contract provisions and litigating contractual disputes, which is one of the reasons he's here to talk to us today about the do's and don'ts for PSAs. Additionally, Bruce has a deep background in a wide spectrum of litigation that impacts the energy sector, including professional liability, products and premises liability, employment disputes, construction-related litigation, and catastrophic injury and death. Bruce is also a full member of the Texas Association of Mediators, and he often assists parties in resolving complex disputes. So, without further ado, I hope you enjoy Bruce's presentation.
Thank you, Tom, and thank all of you for being here. You know, when I heard him say decades of experience, it isn't just a white beard, it did make me feel old. But today I'm going to talk with you some about the pitfalls of purchase and sale agreements. And that is such a broad topic that I could have come up with probably 200 or 300 topics. Today I chose three, and given the 20-minute time that I have allotted, probably going to get through two. One thing I've learned about today, the difference in Houston lawyers and Dallas lawyers, I'm the only Dallas speaker today, is we put disclaimers. We put disclaimers in, but since we're in San Antonio, we'll pass through them. Okay, common pitfalls. First one is contracting before you want to contract. There, I'm going to focus on letters of intent, memorandums of understanding, that type of thing, because many times you will believe that you do not have an agreement, and the other side will take you to court trying to prove that you do have an agreement and it's enforceable. Second is protecting against environmental liabilities. That's primarily a big part of my job, so I'll talk about that some. And then if we had time, but I don't think we're going to get to it, is understanding contractual indemnities. These are three of the areas that I see contractually litigated more than a lot of others. First, contracting before you want to contract. And many times I know as an attorney representing clients, I feel like I'm on that tightrope because the client wants to put everything imaginable and get it firmed up as much as they can in the letter of intent. As an attorney, you're very careful of that because even though if you have an enforceable letter of intent, you can follow it up with a full contract, you don't have to. And maybe the other side, all of a sudden, something sours, whatever, they say, you know, I'm pretty happy with that term sheet that we have now, that letter of intent. So, very basic, a letter of intent, often called a memorandum of understanding, is to facilitate. It is to start a business deal between the parties involved by identifying the key business and contractual understandings. It's a place to start. That will form the basis of a final contract. It is almost never, unless somebody's being a little devious, the intent of a letter of intent for it to be your final contract. Now, here are two frequently cited cases. I'll go through them briefly. Now, the Scott case held that you can enter into a letter of intent, not enforceable, but within that letter of intent, you can have enforceable provisions. It demonstrates the importance of identifying specific binding and non-binding paragraphs or provisions. The Ferretta case, there is somebody, and we see this a lot, in the letter of intent, it says, yeah, we have all these items agreed, but They're all subject to legal documentation. Or this is all subject to a later agreement between the parties. That's great. But that in itself doesn't mean that it is unenforceable. The court has held that that is some evidence of it being unenforceable. The jury, in fact, in this case, found that handwritten initial term sheet between the parties was, in fact, enforceable as the contract. Again, demonstrates the importance of clear and unambiguous drafting on letters of intent. Again, they can be binding, non-binding, or most of your letters of intent are going to be partially binding. The obvious intent of your letter must be apparent from its wording. And then I get to add this for two reasons. One is A Knight's Tale with Heath Ledger. I always really like the movie. And the other one is I love this statement. This is my word, and as such is beyond contestation. When you're writing a letter of intent, when you're writing your contract, you want to make it beyond contestation. Nobody can come in and contest the intent. So letters of intent, binding or not binding. I would suggest that you should assume that the letter of intent would be binding unless you have strong disclaimer language. I would avoid magic words such as offer, acceptance, agreed, terms to be negotiated, because none of them are clear enough to tell you that you do not have a supportable, enforceable agreement. Thought this is interesting a little bit. You'll see many times both parties are going to proceed with good faith or in a good faith effort. The courts have held, yeah, that may be enforceable, but because you don't actually have an agreement otherwise, there's no damages. So there may be a benefit to putting good faith or good faith effort because it's just, maybe it's morally, people feel more compelled to go forth and negotiate on an even basis, but really there's no damage if in fact you breach it. Partially binding. I would suggest in your letters of intent, if you're going to have any binding provisions in there, and normally you're going to, that you specifically identify them as being binding and enforceable. And of course, on the other side, I would disclaim that all other provisions are binding. I would state something such as, otherwise, except for these binding provisions, the other provisions are for discussion purposes only. And does not create, waive, or modify any right, obligation, claim, or liability. I would make it beyond contestation. And again, do not rely upon the subject to legal documentation or similar language. Again, the courts have held that that may be some evidence, but in and of itself is not conclusive. Common binding provisions. Probably, and I usually access for environmental due diligence, but it can be other due diligence, will be binding. You're exclusively dealing with each other during this period of time. Whoever you're dealing with is not going to come in and try to solicit your employees or your customers that they may learn of during the process, that the company or both companies are going to conduct their business in a certain manner during the period of the negotiation. Confidentiality. And the other part here is materials returned. Many times you exchange materials and you don't have a provision in your letter of intent to have those materials returned. You still have the confidentiality agreement, but nobody wants to go ahead and sue in a confidentiality agreement. You'd like to get your materials back if you can. And then termination rights. Seems very simple, but can you terminate at any time? Is there a certain period? Do you have to have cause? Does it have to be in writing? Who do you have to deliver it to? And is there a penalty associated with you terminating the agreement? So the second pitfall is protecting against environmental liabilities. This is actually a site that I'm working on down in Houston right now. And I don't know, everybody here has probably touched some environmental liabilities or something close to it. This is a case where we had 1,300 defendants. It's a, right now they estimate the cleanup cost will be $30 to $40 million, but the plaintiff group is basing any settlement negotiations off of a potential $1 billion cleanup. So once you get in with your 1,299 other defendants, getting out could be really difficult. And the case has already, I think, progressed for about 4 years. We're probably going to have a stay entered for a short period of time where the EPA does a study, and then we'll get it back up again, and maybe 10 years from now, everything will get resolved. So talk about environmental due diligence in your agreements. identify and address environmental concerns before the transaction closes. Of course, you don't want to do it afterwards. Potential liability protection under certain environmental statutes. We'll talk about that a little bit. You can get protection under CERCLA and others. You assess your environmental risk. Use in negotiating your contract terms. Determine who's responsible for any further investigation or potential corrective action. Because it's one thing to go out and investigate, to conduct your due diligence. The other thing is, what are you going to do once you discover whatever you discover? And minimize potential legal claims. The problem we want to prevent, and if you can't read it, it says, my problem is that I invested in liabilities that I thought were assets. And we may have all seen that a time or two. Here are some due diligence considerations. Your access agreement. Of course, you will want it in writing. You'll want to describe the breadth of your due diligence. It's going to be for a certain period most of the time. And the question is, most of the time, if you're going on to somebody else's property, either to just do an inspection or you're actually to be taking some type of soil or groundwater samples, they're going to want you to have insurance. And there can be certain levels of that insurance. What you're looking for, of course, is attempting to discover potential on-site conditions. And does anybody here work with phase one or phase two environmental site assessments? Everybody knows about them? Okay. We'll talk about them in a little bit in a few minutes. Then you have reporting obligations. And I am asked very often, who has reporting obligations? And that means you go out, you look at a site, you decide that you need to do what's called a phase two and to take samples, and you discover you've got a problem. A portion of the property is contaminated. Do you then have an obligation to report it to the state? Does the owner have an obligation to report it to the state? And quite often the question is, what do you want to know? Meaning that if you are selling the property, if you're selling the leases on the property, if you're operating on the property, and the other side wants to conduct the environmental due diligence, do you want a copy of that report? Because you may have the obligation as the owner or operator to then report it to the state. I've seen a number of deals that the owner says, you can conduct whatever due diligence you want, just don't tell me what the results are. You can back out of the deal, you can stay in the deal, but I don't want to know what the results are. You want to know, of course, whether there's any compliance violations. You need to know the current status and the history. And the history is important because the history, especially, I'll say especially in Texas, but it's pretty much everywhere, your penalties grow over time with the TCEQ, with EPA, if you have past violations. And it may not apply to the entity that is operating or owning. It may apply to the facility. I need to know, of course, what permits and licenses, whether they're current, whether they have all of them that are necessary. I've seen that seen a lot of unpermitted wetland problems in oil and gas. Whether you have any type of activity use limitation, normally that's a deed restriction, may say, because of contamination that we found previously on this property, you can't use the groundwater, for example. And most people don't care about using the groundwater. Some industries may care about using the groundwater. Potential liability for off-site conditions disposal. For example, on the case that I cited to you earlier in Houston, I had three clients in it. One of them, they had just a very small percentage, but they had about 1,100 gallons of oily water that they called a licensed transporter to come and get and take to this facility, which was licensed to dispose of it. What did they do wrong? Nothing. They did everything they were supposed to do. Are they liable? Yes, because the environmental statutes are strict liability statutes. Don't have to do anything wrong. So it's important to know, did this facility have a hit, 30 years of disposing of things off-site, and where did they dispose of them? Are records available for chemical storage, use, and disposal? Communications with regulatory agencies, the history of prior owners and operators. Most environmental attorneys will refer to them as PRPs, or potentially responsible parties, because once you own or operate a property, you're forever in the position of potential liability. Which means if they show that you are a owner or operator of the property, you have to prove that you weren't under very limited defenses. Not that you weren't a owner or operator, but that you didn't contribute in any way to the contamination, which is almost impossible to do under many statutes. For example, CERCLA, to share with you, there's sole act of God defense. That doesn't come in very often. Sole act of war defense. That doesn't come in very often. And the sole act of a third party of which you have no relationship with. Now, there's some things that you can do with the phase one, phase two that I'll talk to you about in a minute that you can come into the property, you can take possession of, you can purchase a contaminated property and not have liability. You can acquire a non-contaminated property and not have liability. But you have to dance through some hoops. Environmental insurance coverage. Environmental insurance is relatively new, relatively expensive. Most places don't have it. Okay. How do you avoid liability? For example, under CERCLA and some other statutes, is you have to conduct what's called a phase one environmental assessment. All right, what's a phase one? Phase one, again, is non-invasive. You're not actually taking any samples. What it essentially is an environmental professional is going to look at all of the government-type documents, all the historic aerial photos, maps, going to go to the property, look at the property, going to ask the owner, maybe ask prior owners, hey, you know anything bad that's happened on this property? And they're going to provide you with a report. In that report, they're going to say, I didn't find any type of recognized environmental condition. Or they're going to say, I did find a recognized environmental condition. And if they do find what's called a REC or a recognized environmental condition, then it's incumbent on you, if you want the protection and if you want to know what's actually at the property, to conduct a phase two. But a lot of people are surprised. I'm not sure how my artwork is coming in here, but the a standard phase one, people think, tell you everything about the property and the environmental condition of the property. It does not. It doesn't actually tell you whether there's any soil or groundwater contamination. It doesn't tell you anything about asbestos, radon, lead-based paint, wetlands, oil and gas wells, industrial hygiene, health and safety, endangered species. There's a litany of them. These can be added. And, of course, the environmental professional is happy for you to add them because they all cost more for the report. Limitations on phase one, and this is where a number of clients get in trouble. They will say the landlord or the present owner had a phase one done 5 years ago. Here it is. Everything's clean. I go, well, that really doesn't work. It has a limited shelf life. It's only good for 1 year, and there are five portions of that phase one that has to be updated within 180 days of the transaction, which gets to be really sticky depending on your transaction, because you may have a phase one and you don't actually close for 2 years. It does not include all environmental concerns or provide protection from all environmental laws. It can be used by and provide protection for the identified users only. So if you have a usable phase one, but it is for another party, you have no protections from that. You either have to be identified as a user within the report, or you have to have a reliance letter that allows you to be a user of the report. Okay, when you get a phase one and it recommends you do something more, best thing to do is do something more. And as you would think in legal circles, after you do a phase one, it's called a phase two. You determine the scope of the investigation, determine who wants to see the results, determine who will pay for the phase two and any further investigation. And you should agree on this up front without question. Determine soil, groundwater, and the newest thing is vapor. Any type of volatile vapor is impacted at levels that require additional investigation, monitoring, reporting, or corrective action. Again, if you have the phase two, you don't find anything, then you're done with your environmental due diligence. Limitations of phase two. It's not fully compressed, comprehensive. And that is, you may go out and take soil samples, groundwater samples, but you're not going to take soil and groundwater from the entire property. You have scope limitations, again, locations that you're actually sampling, what chemicals of concern. You're looking at what type of media, soil, groundwater, et cetera, the type of testing that's performed. Data gaps and assumptions. You may go and drill 10 holes in a 20-acre property, and you just have to assume that everything in between is the same. Does not actually quantify the environmental risk. Does not usually provide an action plan. You will see seller and buyer's definitions and provisions, and you will, this is pretty commonplace. And I apologize for trying to talk so fast, but I'm trying to get through this. The seller would typically attempt to narrowly define environmental laws and only want to tell you about actual violations. If you are a buyer, you would prefer a much broader definition, of course, of environmental laws. And other than just learning what they have already been caught by the regulatory agencies with regard to noncompliance, you'll want a representation that they, in fact, are in full compliance to their actual knowledge for all environmental laws. And where we're going to get to contractual indemnities, we're not going to, but I will tell you this, probably that you already know, I see a lot of litigation off of the indemnities. I think that we have a tendency to make indemnities boilerplate, and we use the same ones they used 20 years ago, and the law has changed. And enforcing, and I'll, as you know also, every contract provision is great until it's not. Yeah. And so I would encourage you to keep current on contractual indemnities. I'm happy to talk to anybody after, and thank you.
Thank you for listening to Energy Law Roundup. If you would like additional information about anything from today's episode, you can contact Tom at 210-446-6999 or by email at tom@charlone.net. New episodes of this podcast are available every week on the web at www.energylawroundup.com, your one-stop source for breaking news and developments in energy law.